We are. I just want to.
I listened to you with Todd.
Oh yeah.
Yeah, you asked very good questions.
Thank you, my friend.
Yeah, I was good.
All right, let's get your levels.
Levels.
Your levels. Look at yours. Levels. Are good.
Let me get my chair up a little.
What you know, by the way, with the Sidewalk Radio Extra, I don't edit a thing. So get your chair right.
Oh, you did.
I know, but I lied to get you in here.
On. What if I say, wait? You got to redo that one.
We might.
That'll
we can.
Part of the show.
We'll see. Water?
I won't be talking that loud, will I?
Probably not. But, you know, look.
Why does this thing keep sinking?
Hey, as long as it's not a ship. You know what I'm saying?
I guess.
You spent.
Not really.
Actually, you know, I always do this, especially with people that I
no,
really
I didn't
like.
Spend a lot of time on boats.
I don't want to get too far into this interview without telling the people who we're having the pleasure of speaking with.
Oh, really? You tell people who they're listening to?
Sometimes.
They have to guess?
I think telepathy will come up later in the show.
All right.
Tell people who you are.
What do you mean?
Like, what's your name and what are you up to?
Peter Behuth. I'm a 3D stereoscopic photographer. I'm also a hospitality mogul.
It's true. Isn't it fun you can say that and it'd be true?
Hospitality mogul? Sounds like you could be like anybody, right? Like a Hilton. Or on Airbnb.
You're on the Airbnb.
I'm on the Airbnb side. But I'm kind of mogulish on the Airbnb thing. You know, we got a popular little spot.
Yeah, y'all do. Y'all got the tree houses.
We have the tree houses, yeah.
You know, when people hear treehouse, they think little house in a tree, like playing.
They don't know what to think.
I think like the Little Rascals type of thing.
Right. You know? Like a tree fort. Like a fort. Well, you know, the treehouses are all about, it's not really, I mean, these are nice, you can stay in them, but, you know, they came from the idea of when you had a treehouse when you were a kid. Mine was like a board in a 8-foot tree, but when I was up there, I knew what the meaning of sovereignty was, you know, my own country, my rules, I'm up here, this is my domain, and that's the feeling of a treehouse that you try to get. Which you get in these, even though they're kind of nice and.
But they're on your property, and you have other people staying them. Are you saying that you wanted to create something for other people to have their sovereignty, or
no.
Was that not even in the picture?
No, it wasn't in the picture because I built them for myself 14 years ago, and they've only been on Airbnb for the last couple of years. So I had no idea that anybody, a stranger out there, I thought, what would that mean? Like some homeless person ends up there at night, or so. I just didn't think that would ever happen.
How did it come to be?
I read an interview with a guy that did Airbnb, and he said people are looking for a unique experience, and they're staying in all sorts of things, but the most popular are treehouses. And I said, oh, I've got the best treehouse because I've got a treehouse suite. You know, there's three of them, so you don't get cabin fever.
Can you describe what they are?
Well, I think one element of their success has been that you see them all the time, actually, in social media. So it's not really even been through Airbnb that people get to know them. They see them, people post images all the time. It just shows you the strength of, you know, when people, there's always this joke, we're going to do an ad and we want it to go viral. You know, that never happens. But sometimes things kind of on their own get a little viral, and this kind of did. And when I built them, there were certain elements I wanted. I wanted three for some, you know, nice odd number. Mm-hmm. I wanted three different purposes. One was kind of like a lawless salon, you know, sitting room. And I always wanted a bed that rolled out on a platform outside. I always thought that every bedroom you should be able to roll your bed outside when it's nice out. So there's the bedroom, which has a platform where the bed rolls out over this little creek. And then there's the last tree. There's kind of a deck around this last tree that is a very significant tree in the neighborhood. I call him the old man. He's about 165 years old. He was, you know, southern shortleaf pine, beautiful tree, biggest tree in the neighborhood, been here since the Civil War. And he kind of watches over the place. He really gives it the personality that the treehouses have. So
when you were building the treehouses 14 years ago, did you look out of your home and see this incredible tree and say, man, I want to build a treehouse there? How did that happen?
It really came out far different from that. I mean, I didn't see it that way.
I'm usually wrong on Sidewalk Radio.
No. It's a really good question. You know, it took a lot longer to plan than it did to build, actually, because I wanted to use found materials. And I found the first window about a block away from my house. And then I started searching around salvage places, found old restaurant doors. My mother had these 80-year-old windows from a shrine, from a like a Masonic shrine in Syracuse that had been demolished, that had butterflies actually pressed between the glass. And she had 10 of those just hanging around. But that's a perfect treehouse window, right? But, you know, when you build treehouses, you know, it's not your usual construction. First of all, treehouses are the only thing you can build when you're not an architect, right? So if you're not an architect. So you could just put these things up, but the trees have a lot to say about it, and luck has a lot to say about it. And things happen that I would never have imagined that just worked out perfectly, and I don't know how that happened, except that there was just kind of a good positive, it was a good positive project. But there was a reason I did.
Why is that?
Because at the time I was still in the middle of my activist career, and I would come home at the end of the day and I would not be able to see anything that was a product of my work. You know, I couldn't tell you how far I had gotten working on climate change or, you know, doing any number of things that I was working on. And I wanted, you know, you want to be able to see something that you built. And I think that, you know, I do admire people that build things. I think that building things and knowing how to build things is really important in today's society. You know, most people don't even know how to change the oil anymore or what happens if a light goes on in their car. But to be able to do things with your hands, to be able to see that you built that, you have to stand by it, right? Good or bad, is a pretty valuable thing to me, particularly when you have work that you just don't see that.
Yeah.
You know, I couldn't even say I painted the side of that building at the end of a day.
You and I became friends in what I would say is a fairly random way, Sidewalk Radio, you know, because having this show that talks about history and culture and art,
right,
and caring about that landscape here in Atlanta,
right,
you know, I've got to know some great people, and some of those people know you, and you had an art exhibit that I got to come and be on a panel for, and that's how we met.
Yes.
But the real story is that I got asked to be on the panel before we met.
Yes.
And then you called me and you said, "Hey, I'm Peter. You're going to be on this panel. Would you like to come to my house and hang out and get to know each other?"
Huh, right.
And I had to ask my wife if that was okay.
Right.
And it was.
Why? Because we're not supposed to maybe meet before you're on the panel?
No, I might have influenced you. It was more like, I'm going to go hang out at a strange man's house for like 3 hours.
Jeez, being a strange man is so unbecoming, isn't it?
It's good. No, but... You know, it's like, it's, as you know, as a husband, there's like the courtesy of asking if you can go spend a couple of hours doing anything.
We need more male friends, Gene. That's one of the issues, right?
I think it's an incredible
deal. Well, let me tell you.
But real quick, because I do have a question for you. With that, you know, when we met, at least for me, there was an instant connection.
Mm-hmm.
And that connection... I think would have happened anyway, but it happened to coincide with a time in my life where I think that I was feeling the same way that you did when you built the treehouses or started to plan them, which is like, I need to like be a part of something new and different. It's time to kind of take a stand, so to speak. Mm-hmm. And then it was very coincidental that your exhibit, Henry, which I want to talk about, spoke about those themes.
Well, I'm a very insecure artist because I'm autodidact. I train myself. And, you know, so I don't have the security of, you know, I got good grades at art school or, you know, I was actually trained. So, you know, I tend to be pretty collaborative. But when you're going to have a panel that's going to talk about your work and you don't know these people, it's a funny feeling. And I kind of like the idea of the conversation. Like, okay, so I don't know these people. Maybe that's the way it's supposed to be, but I'd like to maybe know who these people are. And it's kind of like, I want to have a conversation with someone who I'm going to somehow be involved in or is going to say things about things I work on without knowing that person is a little strange to me. You know, we have these very stripped down conversations with people now, these text messages and, you know, everything else. And it's a little unsatisfying for me. You know, where's that phone call where you go, "Hey, Gene, how you doing? What's going on?" You know, and maybe have a... Now, I know maybe that's a superficial conversation, but not always.
You can get it to where it's not. You know,
I think that's why people want a text, is because those conversations sometimes go on. People don't really have the time or whatever, but
and sometimes we don't want to get into it, you know.
Right, we don't.
But we're in it now.
We're in it. I think it's a good thing.
I show up at your
house. How we evolve.
Yeah. I show up at your house.
Yeah.
It's incredible, by the way. Just this house in a pretty densely wooded area. It's surrounded by other homes which you never see. You see the tree houses, but you see them because you've got these tilted up, like full windowed walls. The walls themselves are windows.
Of the main house.
My house,
yeah.
That house in itself is incredible.
Yeah. That was a hand-built house, actually, by someone. And that was a funny thing. I walked into that house 5 years before I bought it because I was invited to a party there. And the moment I stepped through the door, I had this overwhelming feeling that at some point I would live in that house. Not like I wanted to and I was, you know, going to somehow maneuver myself so that I would live there. I knew I would live there. 5 years later, the guy was moving and he happened to call me. And I said, "What are you doing with your house?" He said, "It's for sale." I bought it in a half hour. I'd never looked at another house. It was very strange.
Has that been kind of like the story of your life?
Kind of. Yeah. I think running into things has been the story of my life, right?
What do you
like? I'm not much
that
of a
to?
Huh?
What do you attribute that to?
Catching the green lights right when you need to, you know, I think. Or I mean, I think sometimes when you I've never been really much of a planner. It's more been like, if you plan something, I'm not sure that that's the way it would work out. You know, there's a joke. How do you make God laugh? Tell him your plans.
I'm smiling.
But for me, it's been more about, how do you feel? Are you positive about things or are you negative about it? And I tend to think that if you're tend to be on the positive side, which is kind of strange for me to say because I'm not exactly a positive person, but in terms of what I'm kind of interested in, if I'm positive about them, then it kind of, you know, you push your boat into that current and see where it takes you. And you tend to run into the things that you need to run into.
Yeah. I mean, it seems to me, and like, you know, we're good friends, but we haven't been friends for terribly long.
No.
It's been about an hour and a half. No, I mean,
in real time,
you know, it's been about, you know,
yeah,
a year,
right,
or so. And it seems like you are comfortable enough with yourself and the path of life that you've led to be flexible with what's delivered.
I mean, my training and work has been kind of, you know, it's not that it's unfiltered. It's that it's oftentimes outside the normal bounds anyway. You know, Greenpeace was not, you know, I worked at Greenpeace. Greenpeace was not a stay the course, stay within the boundaries of the coloring book kind of organization. And I spent 9 years working almost day to day with Ted Turner, not exactly a let's do it the old way kind of guy.
So, I mean, I know this, but you know, this is the first time, at least on this show, you're sharing this. You work at Greenpeace. You led Greenpeace.
I was the director of Greenpeace in the U.S., yeah, in the late 80s, early 90s.
You were leading the Turner Foundation.
I was the director of Turner Foundation for 9 years.
You are building tree houses.
Yeah. Well, before that, there was the country's largest network of climate change organizations. I was director of that for 7 years.
Didn't even know about that. You are a stereoscopic photographer.
Yeah.
Seems to me like you have led a pretty rich life.
Just where I am. But how many times do I burn? All the love I have is in my mind. But I'm a lucky man with fire. Something in my own place. I'm steady naked, smiling. I feel no disgrace with who I am. Happiness coming and going. I watch you look at me, watch my feet are growing. I know just who I am. And how many corners do I have to turn? How many times do I have to run? All the love I have is in my mind. I hope you understand. I hope you understand.
When we hung out for the first time, and you showed me, you started by showing me some of your collection of 3D photos, not ones that you took, ones that your father took. Did you feel like inspired to do things different, or when did you know that you were kind of different than everyone else? I mean, there are not a whole lot of people that can say, I ran Greenpeace, I built some tree houses, I'm a photographer. You know, I mean, you're different.
Well, like I said, anybody can build a treehouse, right? Any kid can build a treehouse. I had one. It was a board and a tree. You know, I just had a bigger allowance and wanted to do more things, and it worked out well. But it's more about, you know, what makes you happy, right? Okay, so I worked for a billionaire, and here's what I learned. Billionaires are different from even people that have, say, $900 million. You know how they're different? Billionaires have stopped trying to get more. They get to a point where it's like, okay, enough. I've got, right? And what I saw with Ted Turner and with other people I met through him, they get to the point of they do what they like to do. They've earned it. They don't have to be in this competitive, I'm trying to be bigger, more successful, have more money. They get to this point, I'm a billionaire, right? That's a pretty small group. And those people can then say, I'll do what I want. And I think that that philosophy, I'm not going to have $1 billion, but I can live like a billionaire, which means what is it you like doing, right? So there's that.
But I mean, I would argue without being there for your childhood that you were doing what you like and being different from like pretty early on. Am I wrong?
I don't know. I was a pretty quiet kid actually. But well, I do feel that I've been fortunate that I've kind of come in contact with things that have been pretty interesting and fun to do. So, you know, Greenpeace wasn't just a normal environmental organization. It was like being a juvenile delinquent for a cause. You know, it wasn't like being a researcher. And so that was fun. It got me out there. I saw things that I wouldn't have seen otherwise. It was an amazing opportunity for me.
Did that help and hurt the organization?
Me being there?
That too. No, the juvenile delinquent for a cause.
Well, people don't like that phrase. I'm sure that people work there, take their jobs very seriously, and they probably don't like to be called a juvenile delinquent. But what I mean by that is that you could kind of get in the way of something that you saw was wrong, right? And you were doing it for a good purpose. I'm using slang by saying it's like being a juvenile delinquent. But I was pretty much a trained irritant. And I did it for something that I kind of strongly believed in from a justice perspective, right? So that was great. But there were things that left me pretty empty about it as well. And I think that a lot of that was kind of the creativity or lack thereof of advocacy and the fact that it's very hard to gauge what you're doing. You're standing for something, but what do you see from that?
So how do you get someone to join an organization and stay with an organization or a belief where they can't see the tangible results?
Well, if you have a sense of justice and you feel like you should stand up and you have a set of principles that say, you know, you have to take a stand or at least be knowledgeable about these things, well, then it's just kind of something that, you know, you're comfortable with. The problem is that organizations are organizations, and they come with a whole set of issues. And when you are the director of an organization, you have to be as comfortable saying no to things as you are saying yes, just in a organizational structural way.
Yeah.
And after period of time, if you're that kind of person where you're going to be comfortable enough to be a leader to say no, because that's what you have to do, you make enemies. In 30 years of doing advocacy work, believe me, I learned an awful lot about what's going on in the world on a factual basis. And that those things change your mind about how you see things, but it doesn't change the way you feel. Culture changes the way you feel about things. And I thought that advocacy organizations need to do more in terms of accepting cultural approaches, artistic approaches to the world, because that's what art does. It changes the way you feel. And I don't think really in the advocacy world right now, we really change the way people feel about things as much as how they think about things. And that always became a bit of an issue for me. I'll tell you a little secret.
Yeah.
I left every job the same way I came in, which was fired with enthusiasm.
Do you think there are any organizations that are doing it right?
Well, the issue that I spent most of my time in was with the environment. And I would challenge people to identify someone that they see in the media or otherwise that they can say, that person really gets to me. I really trust and learn from that person.
In the media?
Just that the general public sees or knows or hears from. So, for example, in consumer advocacy,
yeah.
Ralph Nader. Whatever you think about him, he is an identifiable leader who will make you think and feel.
What about Neil deGrasse Tyson?
I see him more as like a science-oriented guy that is kind of talking about that in a way that you can then adapt into how you feel about things. I don't think he ever says, well, I think he probably does have opinions, we need to do this or that. But that's not his real job as an advocate to change the whatever he's most interested in. I mean, he's talking about science and exploration, and that's super
like he's motivating,
super
people
foundational. To... You know, it's great.
Yeah,
and he motivates people to be interested in that, which is good. That's not advocacy, though.
No.
He's not running an advocacy organization.
Right, but
it's more of an educational organization.
He could.
Sure. Yeah, he could. Yeah. And I'm sure he could do that advocacy job quite well.
Yeah.
And people know him and they respect him and everything else. That's not what he does. A lot of times now they're part of the incremental industrial negotiating complex, right? Where they have to be pretty comfortable fighting over words in a bill up at in Congress. And, you know, I've done those things, but that's not satisfying to me.
Yeah.
You know?
I mean, to me, a lot of the people who get into those positions have to either have to or think they have to toe the party line.
That's right.
And when they don't, they become you,
right,
which is fired with enthusiasm.
Right.
If you look at Trump, the reason why he is at least being talked about a lot and popular is because he's saying whatever he wants.
He's changing how people, he's getting to what people feel. That's it. So when the Republican establishment goes after him, they're telling people facts. They're saying, factually, he wouldn't, you know, and he's this. That's not what people, they want to feel something, and they feel something for him. When he talks, when he shows up, they feel something. Right or wrong, they feel it.
Right, but he's not going to be the president.
He's not?
I don't think so.
Okay.
You think so?
I don't know.
I really don't think so because, you know, he doesn't toe the line enough, and people in this country and in the world, I believe, survive in what they perceive in their mind as security and control.
The easiest.
I don't think that he offers that totally. I think that it's, I wouldn't call him a flash in the pan. I think that he's helping the conversation for everyone because he's going to bring up issues that we might not otherwise talk about or in a way that we might not talk about them. But I don't think he's got like what it takes to be a leader of the country. And that's, I'm not saying that from a political, I don't really care. Like, I'm not very political.
But people get tired of when they get the sense that people are just doing what they're supposed to do.
Right.
Or that someone's told them what to do or what the powers to be tell them what. And he doesn't. And that is attractive to them,
mm-hmm.
you know? And people are pretty bummed out at politics and feel the polarization. And he's polarizing, right? But he's polarizing in a way that gets to that polarization and makes people feel that and want to go against someone who, I mean, now it's considered if you have experience in the world of politics, you're not a good candidate in people's eyes.
I have his
That's
autograph.
The last thing they want. I watched Every Apprentice.
You did?
Yes, religiously. Because it was a show about trying to get along with people and getting something done and what can happen. Now it's a false dynamic because someone gets fired every time, right? But which isn't usual, but the dynamics between people was really interesting to watch, right? So here's the thing about Trump. He may not be president, right? But because he was bold, because of the boldness of him, right? He's done something that no one's ever done before. He's totally hijacked the Republican Party, and they're freaking. That's how strong his approach has been, that someone was able to come in and go against that establishment where the Republican Party is now thinking, this guy who's not part of our party could be the nominee.
Do you miss being involved with all that craziness?
No.
You love what you're doing.
What I've found is that it's what has sustained me. So the last job where I was fired with enthusiasm, right? It was a pretty rude thing that happened. After 7 years and after 30 years of advocacy, after having built the organization to 3 times its original size when I took the job, I was told to leave in 2 weeks because the person that was on the board that wanted someone else who was maybe more presentable than me or whatever they wanted didn't really have the experience of know how you deal with someone. And it was pretty hurtful. And It solidified for me something I believe about the world, which is we treat the world like we treat each other, and we treat each other badly. And that was an example of it. And when that happened, I could have lost my house, except for one thing. These tree houses that I built 14 years before as just a creative act went out and got a job, and they saved me and my family and from losing my house, which is kind of amazing when you think about it. So when I look back, what sustained me? The relationships I had with people didn't happen. Now that's my fault, right? I can't be a victim about that. I have to take responsibility. But the creative things that I've done in my life have sustained me. So when I bring people to my studio that get in their car every day and they go to work, like we all do or have done, they go, this is what I want to do, what I want to do during my day. Well, you, if you want to do that, then you have to learn how to do something that you love doing. And you have to teach yourself to do it, you know, and you have to make things or
and
whatever.
And there are trade-offs
it
for it.
Sure, there might be trade-offs, but it, what are the trade-offs? Is it financial? You never know. I mean, every artist I know, especially in this city, they're doing something else to sustain themselves. But they're still doing it because they're going to be able to do their work, their art. And if that gets taken away from you, you're not happy, I don't think. So it's, again, living like a billionaire is, what is it that you love doing more than anything else? For Ted Turner, standing in a river, catching trout, he loves it. Now, he has the means to have some of the best trout streams in the world, but nonetheless, he's fishing. Something that anybody can do for nothing, right? So,
well, actually, this is a great segue. And I love when this happens on Sidewalk Radio. You know, these are unplanned conversations, but I like when they go in a direction I really wasn't anticipating. Ted Turner is to standing in the trout stream as your wife Katie is to opening a bookstore.
That's right.
Let's tell folks a little bit about that.
So I describe my wife, Katie Berenger, just opened a bookstore in Atlanta called Cover Books. Katie has always, you know, I think like everybody, wanted to do something of her own that she owned.
It's a happy thing.
It's a happy thing. And she went to New York because she was a little dissatisfied with what she was doing in Atlanta, and she had gone to school in New York. And when you go to school in New York and go back home, you always say, should I have left New York? Isn't that where everybody wants to be? Isn't that where we should be? Isn't that where you make it?
Yeah.
And, you know, when you go back and you live there, you realize, it's not the greatest place to live, right? But what she discovered there was she came up with the thing that she got in touch with the idea of the bookstore, the independent bookstore that you have in New York that may specialize in certain things. And so she came up with this concept of, I'm going to do a bookstore. I've always loved books. And she's very good at it. She's curatorial. She's been trained in the art field. So she opened a bookstore that carried books that covered art, design, food, and wine. And it's beautifully curated. And because of her, just her way and her personality, the place is gorgeous.
You can tell that someone is passionate,
yes,
about what is there.
So she didn't have an idea and pay somebody to build this thing or put it together. She put every bit of herself into it.
Yeah.
And it was, for me, I helped do the build out for it. And building shelves for her was, I would sit there and go, this is some of the happiest moments I've ever had and some of the greatest accomplishments. So I think, wow, I did these things for all these years and I've got my stuff, but I look at this bookshelf and it's like, this is right. It just all felt good and valuable. And
yeah,
I describe it as watching somebody's dream come true and you're in it building shelves. That's kind of what it was like.
Well,
but it was like her, and for her, the planets were lining up as well, finding a place. Having met you, right, through my art show, and you being the person that put us in touch with the perfect place for her bookstore.
Well,
it
was
happened as a side product, byproduct of our relationship, which is, that's a beautiful thing.
That's
right?
That's kind of where I've been fortunate and focused to have my career go, which is not just about like filling another box, but what can I do to play my little part in adding something better to Atlanta, you know? And if that's in part like helping someone realize their dream, it's in part having fun with friends, it's in part like having this incredible bookstore and conversation place on the West Side. So, I mean, I loved it, but you know, like going in, but I knew it was a great space, but it was only a space. It is irrelevant without the person or what's in it.
Right.
And with Cover Books there and with Katie in there, the light is like both brighter and softer at the same time. You know, the place is alive and vibrant, but very chill.
His heart and soul.
It's got heart and soul. It's
her
incredible.
Heart and soul. And what's funny about it is, just to kind of loop it back, I met Katie. I was working on a photography project, and I took a picture of her and the picture is called Cover. This is before Katie and I started dating. She opens a bookstore, Cover Books, taken from the name of that photograph I took of her, which is a great name for a bookstore, but you might not really
photograph.
Come up with it if you, you know, Cover Books, what, you know, or as my mother said, why didn't you call it Just Books?
How old is your mom?
95.
What's she up to?
Well, 95, she's pretty engaged, I got to tell you. I mean, you know, she tried to name the bookstore, as I just said.
That's awesome.
She does these funny things now. You know, one of the reasons I think the environment meant so much to me is that my mother would walk by a flower and say, look at that. That's a miracle. Right? And that would get, you know, I would look at it and say, she's dead on. This thing is gorgeous. And then, you know, you get older and you see things that they're doing to our surroundings, our space, whether it's a flower or like, you know, a forest or the atmosphere. And you go, you're kind of screwing with the miracle here, you know. And I think that's what it is for me. You know, that's my mom. She's a great lady.
She's in Syracuse?
She's still in Syracuse, yeah.
So when I came over that first day when we met, you showed me the 3D photo, your family portrait.
Yeah.
Your mom is kind of like in a dress. She's got a martini glass.
Right.
You're with your brother and your sister.
Yeah.
You're holding a toy. Is that right? And you've got on like these red overalls with an embroidered whale on the front.
Right.
Now, one, incredible photo.
Amazing.
It was so impactful that, you know, we were lucky enough to just commission you to do our family portrait. We love it. I look at that and I know, you know, your history of your career history and this and your pursuit of passions, and I like can't help but think that that photograph was foreshadowing.
Yeah, strange, isn't it?
Yeah.
I mean, I have no memory of that whale on my overalls. And in fact, I never even saw that whale for a long time. I think somebody might have pointed out to me, do you know you're wearing a whale on your overalls and carrying a toy? You know, I have a huge toy collection. That's another thing. But, you know, the thing about those photographs and the reason I do, when I learned photography, I learned 3D stereoscopic photography. I didn't learn photography. I taught myself 3D photography, and there's a reason for that. It's a very old technology that nobody uses anymore. And it's a different way of looking at a photograph because you have to become personally involved, personally, physically active in terms of looking at it because you have to go up and look in a viewer. It's not on a wall. So when you look in that viewer, it's like peeking or it's like looking at a hole in a fence. You don't know what you're going to see until you get there. And then you look and it's all you see. When it's your entire visual context, it's like taking you to that place because the illusion of dimension is there because it's in 3D. So you go into that room, right? And if it's an older photo, you travel in time to that space. So it's time and space travel, and you go to that place on Christmas where my mother would dress us in red and my father would take this photograph. Now, it's not like today where there might be 300 photographs of that day that, you know, one might be attractive to you at one point or another, but that's the photo. It's not.
That's what I love about it.
It's so iconic in the sense that that's an image I have that creates a memory of my childhood, whether I remember being, but I go to that place.
Of an instant.
And that's why I'm so intrigued by that technique, because it's not social media friendly. And I'm kind of an analog person and I'm kind of a preservationist. And I only shoot film. And I'm painting myself into a smaller and smaller corner. I shoot film, not digital. And I shoot stereoscopic. I'm one of the few that does it. But standing in that corner makes you feel as if you're doing something different, right? That makes you, that you're doing something that stands out, right? So everybody says to me, well, do you have a website? Can you show it on your, I can't. You have, it's eyes on the viewer. It's one person at a time. Has to look at it, which makes it very personal, right? Not financially viable, maybe, but personal.
I don't know about that. I mean, it's to me, the real beauty is that it's much more than a photo. It's an experience and it's a work of art.
It can tell a story.
Yeah, it's incredible.
It really can.
So now you are delving into the world of film. You wrote a screenplay, Bottlenose. Right. I read it. It's incredible. Tell us about why you did it.
So,
come a little closer.
The last project I did, the one that you were on my panel, it was based on ViewMasters from when I was a kid, right? And there was a story that was made from dioramas in the 50s about a kid named Sam Sawyer, and he would go to the moon and fight the aliens. And I wanted to do a contemporary version of, like, the ViewMaster reel, because those were our first photograph collections when we were kids, were these 3D ViewMasters. So people know what 3D is. So I like the history. That's how I teach myself. So I studied ViewMasters, and I wanted to make my own, so I did this story. But it was really, and I don't know that many people saw this, I think you did, but it was really kind of a commentary. The reason he went into space is because he was imagining a new world. So it was really in response to things like Ferguson. It was in response to polarization, that we have such a hard time getting past that, that maybe what we need to do is look up and imagine something different before we try to solve the polarization. We have to imagine a different place. And that's what that story was about. So it was about a boy who builds a rocket ship and goes looking for a new safe place. So,
and understanding at the same time that he was leaving something familiar and that it would be lonely.
Something he loved.
Something he
and
loved.
And it made him sad, right? Yeah. So I realized this. Yeah. I'm not advocating we leave. It was about, it was space as a metaphor for imagining a different place.
Well, that's but when kind I think what I about say. It's a trade-off, too. You right. can't have everything.
Right.
You can't have everything. Right.
But I'm not, I'm not an advocate of leaving the planet, leaving our trash behind. So when I think about this place and I think about a different way of thinking about our Earth, I started to think about the idea of what if we were to communicate with another species? What would that look like and why? How would that happen? And that's what Bottlenose is about. It's that story of a 14-year-old girl's communication with another species that chooses to communicate with her, that has been on the planet for over 50 million years, that once lived on land and evolved into the water, and their brains have evolved for 50 million years. Ours have maybe at most 10 million. And their brains have evolved in a way that is finely tuned towards their associations with each other and with other groups. So dolphins have very tight bonds with their families, with their pods, and with other larger pods of animals. And their brain is evolved to do this. And so what would this girl learn from this communication? What would she pick up from it and why? What would listening to that brain look like? And how does she deal with that? So if you take a dolphin, if you look at dolphins, we treat dolphins in this world as everything from lunch meat by slaughtering them in Japan and selling them to school lunches, to some people who think they're aliens that built the pyramids and came from the star Sirius. That's a pretty wide swath. We obviously don't know how to deal with any other species.
I think I'm somewhere in the middle.
Right, right, exactly. And that's what this movie does.
Yeah.
Like, it tries to drive through the middle of that and say, let's really think about this, right? And imagine what that might look like and how, and what would be good and what would be weird and everything else about it.
And
what does it say about how we deal with each other?
Right. So that's what I was going to ask. How much is it about, like, dolphins and the environment and advocacy and none?
Not really. It's really about our evolution. What we do with things that we learn. You know, do we pick up the sword, right? What happens when you pick up the sword? What pushback do you get? Why do you do it? What are you listening? Can you listen to something that's different? And can you act on it? Can you believe in something if no one else believes you? This dolphin does not communicate to anybody else, doesn't show up to anybody else, only to her. It's like almost like dolphin Snapchat. So she can't prove it, right? But she knows it. So when you know something and everybody else is opposed to it and doesn't believe you, can you stand by it? So it's you know, there's a lot of themes in there. There's the theme of analog in the conversation versus electronics and how we communicate, how we use electronics to communicate. So, yeah, it's those kind of things. But it's really about us.
Are these, and I love it. I can't wait to see it, you know.
But I just woke up and I had the story. And I've never written like this before in my life, but I had this story because someone asked me a question about like what was, you know, just something prompted it. And I just woke up in the middle of the night and I had the story. I said, this is a story. I got a story in my head. And I started writing. And I'm sitting there writing conversations between this 14-year-old girl and her mother and thinking to myself, how am I writing this? I don't, you know, what experience do I have to write this dialogue? But it just kind of came. It just kind of flowed. And I think it's kind of funny. There's some pretty good characters in it. There's a very contemporary society. Relationship between this 14-year-old girl and someone who was an advocate in the past that becomes a bit of a mentor, but yeah. Because he's an older male and she's they can't really be friends in today's society. It's not appropriate, but so how do they communicate and listen to each other when there's that kind of stigma against that just not being a relationship that anybody in society ever wants to see?
Yeah.
You know, can't be trusted, so...
The entire story and you waking up and writing it doesn't surprise me at all. I mean, you have an entire life full of experiences that came together and your own brain has been evolving to get to this point to where you can just spit this out. You don't start when you're 15 and write a story without having lived. You've lived a lot.
Well, maybe it's desperation. I mean, my 30 years of advocacy doesn't seem to have any value anymore.
It does.
So you got to do something.
Right? All right. So let's give, because we're almost
we're
at an hour. But
you're walking away, aren't you?
I'm not walking away, but we're being kicked out of the studio.
I hope I didn't ramble too much, but you prompted some, those are some things that people never ask me. You know what was always funny about having come from Greenpeace? Is when I moved here, I would say that over the first 10 years that I was here, maybe 5 people asked me what that experience was like. And that always was funny to me, you know?
I'm always shocked by people being a guest on this show and then not listening to their own show. It's not about...
Does that happen?
Yeah, a lot. It's not
you
about,
see people go on shows and they've never seen the show. Have you ever seen somebody go on, like when Colbert had a show, they go on and they obviously have never seen the show.
Yeah.
And it's like, really? That's pretty arrogant. That's not doing your homework.
I hope you'll enjoy your show.
I'll definitely listen to it, I promise you. I've listened to others.
Thank you, my bro.
Thank you.